meeting to introduce our speaker today. And it's my pleasure to introduce Tony Goldberg. He's in my department, Pathobiological Sciences. And today he'll be talking about ecology and evolution of West Nile virus in Chicago. And also he's going to be making an announcement about a seminar tonight, so be sure to note that.
Thank you very much, Kristen. Yes. So a couple of announcements. First of all, you may notice that this is a well-attended seminar. I'd like to claim credit, but I really can't because it's actually the fusion of two seminars that both meet at noon on Thursdays, the virology seminar and the evolution seminar. And I'd like to make the suggestion that virology and evolution actually have a lot to do with each other and that it might be fruitful in the future to look for speakers that cross between the two disciplines and try to do more coordinated seminars because certainly it would be food for thought and discussion. And in that light, I'd like to make an announcement that tonight at 5 o'clock, Dr. Paul Ewald will be giving the Hildale Lecture for the Biological Sciences on infectious causes of cancer, many of which are viral. And that should be a really interesting talk. And if I'm wrong, Paul can disagree with me because he's right there. So, yeah, it's going to be a great talk. Great talk. So, anyway, please do attend 5 o'clock in the Ebeling Symposium Center of the Microbial Sciences Building. Only been here like a year and a half and I still have problems with all the names. But today I want to talk about a study that I and my collaborators have been involved in for the past 5 years on the ecology of West Nile virus in Chicago. And I want to do two things. I want to tell you a little bit about the findings we've made in that time, which are interesting in that they show how urban ecology can affect the transmission and evolution of a viral pathogen. And then I want to take this opportunity to present some novel findings that we've recently made and we're about to submit for publication that are very intriguing but that we need help with. So having both evolutionary biologists and virologists in the same audience should be useful. So, West Nile virus, as many of you will know, is in the viral family Flaviviridae, and specifically within the Japanese encephalitis antigenic complex of viruses. It's a single-stranded positive sense RNA virus, only 15,000 bases long, and it's vector-borne, as everyone here knows. It's maintained through an enzootic transmission cycle that involves birds and mosquitoes. And in this part of the world, in the northeastern and midwestern United States, it's primarily Culex pipiens, the northern house mosquito, that transmits West Nile virus. And it became famous because of its zoonotic potential. It infects multiple species in addition to birds and mosquitoes, including mammals such as humans and horses, which got everyone's attention in 1999 when the virus was introduced probably from Israel into the northeastern United States and then spread rapidly throughout North America. So now it is endemic in North America and occasionally spills over into people to cause clinical disease. So this is one of the first whole genome phylogenies of West Nile virus that incorporated North American isolates, and this you can see that this group has divided this tree into old world viruses, viruses from the eastern USA, and viruses from North America between 2002 and 2004. And people made the observation early on that this group of viruses from North America between 2002 and 2004 was a clade on this tree and seemed derived with comparison to viruses from the eastern USA and the old world. And in fact, I have here in red the prototype New York 99 virus that was the earliest West Nile virus introduced into the US, and the Israel 1998 virus that you can see is an outgroup to this entire USA clade of the tree. So this is the genetic evidence that West Nile virus was introduced into New York from Israel. But people have become very intrigued with this idea that this North America 2002 to 2004 group of viruses is important because now, if you go out into the world, in anywhere in North America, these are the only viruses that you find, the so-called West Nile 02 genotype. You don't find any more of these New York 99-like genotypes. This one has taken over. And in a very nice study, this was shown by Snappin and colleagues out of Laura Kramer's lab in Journal of Virology in 2007. Here they just plotted, this is based on diagnostic laboratory submissions around the United States, by year, the number, the percentage of the total submissions that were attributable to the New York 99 genotype versus this West Nile 02 genotype. And you can see this steady decline, this actually precipitous decline, in the frequency of New York 99 right around 2002, and this precipitous increase in the frequency of West Nile 02 genotype, such that by 2004, that's all you found. And as I said, there's been complete and utter replacement of the New York 99 genotype by the newer, more derived West Nile 02 genotype. So this was clearly fodder for experimental studies, which have been quite informative. This was a nice one published a couple of years ago in American Journal of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, just looking at the growth and infectivity characteristics of these two genotypes of West Nile virus. This is just their platform units per mosquito after intrathoracic inoculation into Culex pipiens, and you can see that although not dramatic, there is a difference in the and the titer to which the West Nile 02 genotype grows relative to the New York 99 genotype. And these types of data, in combination with epidemiological modeling, lead to the conclusion that the extrinsic incubation period following per oral inoculation for West Nile 02 is 2 days shorter than for New York 99. And the extrinsic incubation period in the vernacular of epidemiology is the time it takes for a mosquito or any vector to be infected with a virus and then be able to transmit it. So what this means is that this new West Nile 02 genotype gets through the mosquito and becomes infective in the mosquito 2 days more quickly than the New York 99 genotype. So I always like to start with this example because it's a wonderful example of viral evolution by natural selection. We have an introduction of a virus with a particular genotype into New York, in this case in 1999, and then a mutation. And in fact, it looks to be a single nucleotide substitution, a uracil turning into a cytosine in position 1442 of the viral genome that confers a lot of this. And that particular mutation has a selective advantage due to faster replication in the North American vector Culex pipiens, which led to the continent-wide replacement of that less fit New York 99 genotype by the more fit West Nile 02 genotype. So adaptation of West Nile to its new environment, which I just like as a story. So armed with that perspective, my group of collaborators and I stepped back and we realized that many people had been studying West Nile virus on a very coarse geographic temporal scale, the North America, or time spans of years. But there were very few studies actually looking at what the virus was doing in specific places on the ground. Or there was lack, we argued, of a fine scale perspective, and I guess we argued well because we got funded. So we chose to look in Chicago. At this time, I was at University of Illinois, and Chicago was always a fun trip, so working in Chicago was a great idea. But it was also a great idea because in 2002, when West Nile really hit the Midwest, Illinois led the United States in the number of human West Nile cases. And to this day, Chicago and the surrounding suburbs continue to be hotspots of infection. The reason I say that is that every year since the introduction of West Nile, we have a predictable annual spike of human cases and bird cases beginning in August and September, and I'll show you some data to support that. And if you look at the distribution of human cases in 2002, when the virus first hit, you don't need any statistics, any spatial epidemiology background at all to see that there is a clustered distribution here. We have a general northern cluster right up here. So the city of Chicago is here. This is Lake Michigan. And this is a physiographic map showing the Chicago lake plain and its drainage. And that'll be important for later in the talk. But you can see this cluster of northern cases up here around the Skokie-Evanston area. And then a separate southern cluster right down here in the region of Oak Lawn, for those of you who may know the Chicago suburbs. And the really interesting thing about this is when you do the spatial statistics, some fascinating patterns emerge. So we divided the study area, being Cook and DuPage counties in this case, into hexagons and did some spatial stats. And yes, these are highly statistically significant spatial clusters of human West Nile cases for West Nile in 2002. But people pointed out to us that in 1975, there was also an outbreak of a very similar virus, St. Louis encephalitis, part of the same serogroup. And this is the distribution of human St. Louis encephalitis cases in 1975, showing an exact overlap in the distribution of West Nile and St. Louis encephalitis human cases, again, in the first year that the population of Chicago was exposed. So there's something good about this southern area for the transmission of vector-borne disease in suburban Chicago. So this is why we picked this area as our area for study, which to this day makes me sad, because all of you know, who know Chicago, know that all the good restaurants are up here. And just to give you a historical perspective, this was known even before we looked into it. In 1901, the New York Times published an article on this part of Chicago referring to Chicago's 19th Ward as having dirty streets, filthy alleys, impure water, which caused an epidemic of typhoid fever and malaria. So even as back as over 100 years ago, this is a vector-borne disease hotspot. And I'm going to warn you right now, we don't know why. I'm going to speculate as to why, because I like to speculate. But we have only hypotheses at this point as to why. But within this area, we get this pronounced seasonal amplification of West Nile virus. Early in the season, we have small numbers of birds and small numbers of Culex pipiens mosquitoes exchanging viruses, and very occasionally you do see early season cases spilling over into people or other mammals in around May to July, but that's rare. What happens, it seems, is that as the bird numbers increase and the mosquito numbers increase and transmission between these hosts and this vector increase, then you get this potential for real quote-unquote spillover as mosquitoes start biting things they normally wouldn't, like Rod Blagojevich here and horses, and I can't think of a better explanation other than encephalitis for the behavior of certain people involved in this video. So we compiled data from Cook and DuPage counties in Illinois from their standard mosquito trap data, which was difficult to do, actually, because of various reporting bias issues. But we can clearly document for multiple years this consistent seasonal amplification, as we call it, of West Nile virus. So this is a CDC week right around here. 32 is right around late August, early September. So we see this peak in every year right around the same time, a little delayed in some years, a little bit earlier in others. And the amplitude is quite different. So you can see we have great years for West Nile, like 2006 was a banner year, and really poor years like for West Nile. For example, 2008, which just didn't have the climatic conditions necessary. And that pattern, that overall pattern, does make sense if you look at seasonal average temperatures in Chicago, which tend to peak right around that time. So actually a little bit earlier. So right a few weeks after the hottest, driest times of the year in Chicago, that's when you get the spike in West Nile transmission in this area, which is a little bit counterintuitive considering that it's being transmitted by a mosquito that breeds in water. And that's part of the puzzle. So we continued this with a kind of fine-scale climate analysis where we compiled data from a number of USGS and NOAA and ISWS weather stations. And we classified years in terms of their deviation from average. So this is the abnormal, or the deviation, the cumulative degree weeks in Chicago between 2002 and 2008, our study years. And we can see that there's a range of years, from very cold years in 2008 to very hot years in 2005. So we were able to quantify differences among years and try to build predictive models for the timing and amplitude of that West Nile transmission peak. And the results, I'll just say, are unsatisfying. We see for each individual year, yes, we can say something, maybe precipitation at week 28 and temperature at week 28 for this year, or precipitation at week 24 and temperature at week 33 for this year. it's kind of, you know, we can predict the timing and amplitude of that West Nile transmission based on these variables, but we're getting decent R squareds here, but when we try to generalize across years, we don't really see very strong patterns. And if we look at non-weather variables, we're miserable. So if we look at elevation, impervious surfaces, and we try to find general things that predict the West Nile amplification timing across years based on physical characteristics of the environment, we do a miserable job, only explaining 8% of the variation. And the same thing is true when we look at aspects of the built environment or socioeconomics. So, and in fact, it gets annoying when we start doing this because we get things popping out that we would really just wish would go away. Like, it always comes out that West Nile is more likely to be present in neighborhoods that are white, predominantly white rather than non-white racially, and that's always annoying to explain. It's probably reporting bias and healthcare access bias phenomenon, but we don't have the resolution in the data to address that. And the other thing that comes into play, of course, this is Chicago, race and politics. So a primary determinant of the probability of West Nile virus in any of these small areas we study is which mosquito abatement district that area happens to be in. So certain mosquito abatement districts seem to be doing well, others seem not to be doing well. But again, it's very unsatisfying because we can't really weave a compelling, unified story looking at this scale. So we decided to stop sitting at our computers and looking at satellite images and actually put our boots on and go inside the hotspot, be gumshoe epidemiologists, if you will. And this is what it looks like. We have a mosaic of suburban environments that any of you familiar with Chicago suburbs will know quite well. We have these residential areas characterized by dense housing, industrial sites, roads, and the occasional urban green space in the form of a cemetery or park. Nothing about this environment as you're walking through it screams that this should be an infectious disease hotspot. But we went into that site and chose specific study areas that fall into two general categories, although these are oversimplifications, what we call residential sites, 11 of those, and natural sites, with a big quotation mark around natural. Again, this is suburban Chicago. So a natural site would be an urban green space, a pond, a park, a cemetery. And a residential site would be this very characteristic 1940s to 1960s suburban row housing with lawns and permeable surfaces and low biodiversity. And our protocols were to do massive sampling every year by trapping mosquitoes using the standard methods, light traps, gravity traps, and backpack aspirators, trapping birds in mist nets, testing mosquito pools and bird sera for West Nile virus by RNA, by real-time quantitative PCR. And whenever we get positives, we sequence the envelope gene. And we're currently working on whole viral genome sequences and some deep sequencing work that I don't have results on yet. But within our smaller yet study area, we're still able to document this rapid amplification of West Nile virus right around week 31 here. And you can see still some years are very good, like 2006, some not so good, like 2007. So this is our data from our own mosquito traps and our own testing. And we can document this spike in West Nile virus transmission in mosquitoes. And by plotting out mosquito infection rates on a map and doing some very basic spatial interpolation techniques, we're able to show, or at least suggest, that there's heterogeneity in mosquito infection rates within even this small hotspot, which is only about 10 by 10 kilometers. So we seem to have some vague evidence here that there are little hotspots and some not spots in the same area, although these data are preliminary. But some of the insights that have been most useful have actually been from our studies of what the mosquitoes themselves are eating. We've conducted blood meal analysis on close to 1,500 mosquitoes, most of which are Culex pipiens and other species of Culex, a few of which are different species of mosquitoes. And we were able to identify what they fed on through PCR and sequencing of the cytochrome B gene of the blood meal. And our main cause for failure was advanced stage of digestion of the blood meal. It's very hard to get DNA out of digested blood. But the basic pattern for Culex pipiens, the primary vector of West Nile in this part of the world, is that 80% of blood meals were from birds, as one would expect, and 16% were from mammals. And of those 16% from mammals, 80% were human, and the rest, almost all of the rest, were raccoon. And 4% were other things like tree frogs, which you wouldn't even think live in suburban Chicago, but they do. And the big finding from our blood meal study was this. We calculated an epidemiological parameter called amplification fraction. And this is defined as the fraction of West Nile virus infectious mosquitoes that result from feeding on a particular avian host. So it takes into account not only the blood meal data, but also data on duration, on magnitude of viremia, transmissibility, mosquito avoidance behavior, many of these laboratory experimental parameters that have been quantified in other labs to rank species in terms of their amplification fraction. And as you can see, contrary to what most people might think, American robins stood out as by far the single most important amplifying host of West Nile virus in the suburban Chicago ecosystem. Far more important, in fact, than are crows even on here? I can't remember. Well, blue jays are on here. So people tend to associate West Nile virus with corvids, crows and jays, because they died very quickly. But they die so quickly that they're probably not very important, at least crows aren't, to the perpetuation of West Nile virus in this type of environment. Rather, it seems to be the American robin, which can become infected, stay infected for long enough, not get so sick that it dies, but get somewhat sick and mosquitoes like to feed on it, that seems to be perpetuating transmission in this area. So finding number one after several years was robins. Robins are important. They're abundant, second only in abundance actually to house sparrows. They're actively preferred by Culex pipiens mosquitoes. Well, I should say that they're fed on disproportionately. We don't know if the mosquitoes really like them or if they're just bad at shooing away mosquitoes. And one of our critical insights is that they fledge and expand in population numbers right at the same time that we see that peak in West Nile virus infection rate. So we get an infusion of young, naive hosts as these nestling birds fledge right at the right time to spark this annual amplification. And that observation was also made by Marm Kilpatrick and his group in 2006 in Washington, D.C. and Maryland. And Marm described robins as a West Nile virus super spreader. Now, that's debatable because the term super spreader is usually used to refer to an individual that's very good at spreading disease to lots of other individuals rather than a species. But robins are certainly very important in the ecology of West Nile virus in suburban Chicago. So just showing the data here, we have these are the birds that we catch in our mist nets, the robins that we catch in our mist nets. So you can see the hatchier birds, the ones that are coming out of the nests and fledging and hopping around on the lawns and begging from their parents, are increasing to a maximum right around the same time that avian seroprevalence increases. Viremia, which is rare, we rarely find viremic birds, but we find them right here. Infection rate in Culex peaks, and then human cases just a little delayed as you might expect after that peak Culex infection rate. All this seems to coincide to cause this rapid amplification of West Nile virus in suburban Chicago. And we even got to publish a fun paper on the smoking gun mosquito, we call it. So through these blood meal analyses, we actually were able to find four individual mosquitoes that we identified the blood meal from and were also West Nile virus positive. And they're all Culex pipiens. And two of them had fed on American robins, one on a house sparrow and one on a human. So we and other groups now are convinced that Culex pipiens is not only the most important transmitter of West Nile virus between birds, but also between birds and people, making it a bridge vector, as it's sometimes called. So we're not the only ones to report these types of results. But stepping back a little bit, I still haven't explained how this all comes together to predict this hotspot area. So I want to speculate now because this is a friendly audience. And we've thought a lot about the role of urban architecture in this environment. This is a map of one neighborhood. This was very hard to create because we had to have teams of undergrads going out. The city of Chicago does not know where these things are, but these are catch basins, small drainage
basins that is used to move water out of the neighborhoods during rain events into Lake Michigan. And we've mapped all of them in this one small area. And what you can see is that they're not all along the streets. We're used to seeing catch basins, storm sewers, on the streets here in Madison, Wisconsin, and other places. But here, a lot of them are in alleyways between houses and people's backyards. That arrangement was created to improve drainage, but I think it might have had some unintentional consequences. Here's a photo, a couple of photos of what these things look like. You can see this storm drain is in the middle of a lawn. And I took this picture in September during a hot, dry period. And as you can see, when it's hot and it's dry, you get water trapped in the bottom of these catch basins, along with organic matter such as grass clippings and leaves. And this is heaven if you're a Culex pipiens mosquito and you want to breed. In fact, this is the only breeding habitat available to you. And here I took a mosquito's eye view and put my camera down by the grill of one of these catch basins. And here you can see the catch basin, a porch, and a bird feeder, all in the same shot. So you can visualize this transmission cycle happening on this very fine spatial scale right in suburban Chicago. And although I don't think we'll ever be able to prove it, I believe this is why it's a hotspot. I believe it's an accident of urban architecture that creates a large number of these inconveniently placed storm drains that help facilitate the transmission of West Nile between Culex pipiens vectors that breed here and birds and people that live here. So I call it my coincidence model of West Nile virus amplification. We get the summer weather patterns, urban civil engineering, and the population dynamics of robins all coming together to lead to this precipitous amplification. And I also believe this may be why it happens only at certain northern latitudes, like Chicago. It doesn't seem to happen in Atlanta, where my collaborators are, or places out west where Culex pipiens isn't involved. It seems to happen predominantly in latitudes like Baltimore, New York, Chicago, where you get robin breeding at right around the right time to fuel this sort of amplification cycle. So I'll switch a little bit to what we've done with the virus itself. I mentioned we sequence pretty much all the viruses we get, and we are in the process of working with Greg Ebel at University of New Mexico to do deep sequencing as part of a collaborative study with the Broad Institute. So that's full genome sequences and viral variation within a mosquito. But we're not there yet. When we took an initial look at that with West Nile virus sequences from Chicago in 2005, it was very boring. Our sequences just clustered in this particular tree kind of randomly throughout a tree of North American sequences within that West Nile O2 genotype. Nucleotide diversity was pretty much the same in Chicago as it was anywhere. And we had evidence of strong purifying selection at the nucleotide level, but nothing dramatic. No wacky positive selection or anything we could tell a fun story about. But what we did notice, as we plotted just the raw genetic diversity of West Nile virus that we recovered by year, is that both in the whole state of Illinois between 2002 and 2005, and more recently, between 2005 and 2007, in our small study area in Chicago, we see a steady increase in the overall amount of genetic diversity of West Nile virus within this area. So even though the virus looks boring phylogenetically, it's diversifying actively from year to year, or maybe diversifying passively, since it's not being pulled along. And intriguingly, we see differences, small but suggestive, in viral genetic diversity between different populations of viruses. So we see higher genetic diversity in viruses from mosquitoes than from birds, higher diversity in viruses from birds, and higher diversity in viruses from mosquitoes that we collected from residential sites characterized by suburban housing and impermeable surfaces and lawns than we do in mosquitoes from natural sites. And this is counterintuitive, because we would have predicted the opposite, that we'd see higher viral diversity in the more biodiverse areas, but we don't. And in fact, that trend intrigued us, so we repeated the analysis for 2005, 2006, and 2007, and in all 3 years, we see the same trend where mosquitoes, the genetic diversity of mosquitoes trapped from these residential areas exceeds the diversity of mosquitoes from the natural areas. And we don't achieve statistical significance in 2007, probably because our sample sizes are so small. That was a bad year for West Nile virus transmission. But the trend goes the same way. We've begun to look at some Culex versus non-Culex infected mosquitoes. Non-Culex mosquitoes can get West Nile virus infection. And it looks like the diversity of the virus within the non-Culex mosquitoes is actually slightly higher than within the Culex mosquitoes. And I just wanted to remind you, I showed this picture before. This was our attempt to quantify heterogeneity over space in the transmission rates of West Nile virus in this study area. And I just want you to notice the scale here. This is 1 kilometer. So we're seeing variation around between 1 and 10 kilometers. So we use some fairly crude spatial population genetic analyses. I'll just show one here. An autocorrelation index for DNA analysis, which shows that the farther away in space you get, the less similar viruses tend to get. So viruses recovered from the same sites tended to be very similar, and viruses recovered from different sites, different, and there was a more or less kind of ragged but clinal variation in this trend, showing that we have some evidence of distance-limited viral transmission, even on this very fine spatial scale. And it became interesting when we looked at the evolutionary rate of the virus. We were able to calculate it from Illinois-wide samples between 2002 and 2005 at 0.8 times 10 to the negative 3 substitutions per site per year, which is very typical for a flavivirus like West Nile. But because we knew the day of trapping of each of our mosquito pools, we were able to calculate the same rate for the virus in the Chicago area between July 05 and October 05, and it was 10 times higher than if we just aggregated that rate across the years. So we racked our brains to come up with some sort of unifying hypothesis to explain this. Higher diversity in mosquitoes from these residential sites than from natural sites, higher evolutionary rates within these transmission seasons than between seasons. And what we've come to suspect is that we're seeing evidence of spatial and climatological heterogeneity within the suburban Chicago environment. This is one example, the urban heat island. We have little pockets, well-documented pockets, of higher temperature at scales of just a few kilometers. So real small hot spots within, literally hot spots now, within the city of Chicago. And we speculate that this type of very fine spatial variation in climate might affect local transmission and might account for some of these trends. So I'll just explain that a little bit more. So this idea that mosquitoes from residential sites might have higher diversity than mosquitoes from natural sites in terms of their West Nile virus could arise from these residential sites being just a little bit hotter, transmission being a little bit faster, mutation being a little bit higher. We're not sure, but we're looking into that. I'm not going to spend too much time going over our Bayesian phylodynamic analyses other than to show Bayesian phylodynamics is a way that you can reconstruct the population history of anything, most typically a virus, from DNA sequences or RNA sequences and coalescent theory and computers. But we originally predicted we might see some signature like this in the population dynamics of West Nile virus in Chicago because of this amplification that we see every year. When we actually did the analysis, and I won't go into the details again because I don't want to hang us up on that, the bottom line is that we see no association. We see a very complex but decoupled process. So it's not at all reflective of the seasonal amplification of the virus that we know happens from our own on-the-ground data within transmission seasons. But rather, we see these broad patterns. So we see kind of an increase from 2005 to 2006 and then maybe a decrease in 2007. And yes, 2006 was a bad year for West Nile virus transmission, but there's nothing striking about this pattern. So we don't know what's going on here yet. So our general conclusions are that landscape ecology is important. We see variation in the natural and built environments potentially leading to variation in the transmission of West Nile virus, even within this hotspot. We know that there's variation in the distribution of West Nile virus within this hotspot as a result of the ecology of the vectors, things like those storm drains. We know that these hatchier American robins seem to drive the amplification of West Nile virus in suburban Chicago, but they're also very spottily distributed. And the virus seems to evolve and have genetic diversity differences that are varying on very fine spatial and temporal scales. So kind of to vaguely recall Paul Farmer's book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, we call this hotspots within hotspots, where All of our data to date indicate that these urban foci of arboviral transmission are not homogeneous, but rather that these ecological processes on very fine spatial and temporal scales play a big role, and that they actually may coalesce to form these broader patterns of amplification, and that it's really this level of detail that we need to look at to understand what the fundamental drivers of transmission are in these urban settings. And this is a continuing study, so I'll just go really quickly through some of the studies we have planned. We are, for example, going to be measuring temperature on a very fine scale, so attaching temperature recorders to all of our mosquito traps, for example. Making use of CocoRUNS, the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. These are climate geeks who have weather stations in their backyards and love to upload their data for us and other purposes on a very fine scale, finer than would be found for NOAA or USGS. We're tracking robins. We will be doing that shortly by radio telemetry, following them to their roost sites. We found what we now call mega roosts, aggregations, nighttime aggregations of thousands upon thousands of robins in these Phragmites areas on the banks of creeks. And we think these could be very important fine scale foci of transmission. And this is fun because you can put on your mosquito gear, walk in here at night with a powerful light, walk up to the robins and pluck them off the branch like an apple. We're planning to do mosquito dispersal experiments where we're actually going to spike larval breeding habitats with stable isotopes and use mass spectroscopy to track the movement of mosquitoes from their breeding sites across the suburban landscape to see if we can detect variation in where they choose, quote unquote, to move. And our ultimate goal is to collapse all of these data into predictive models. So as John Yin talked about last week, the idea is to use real data to inform models that are simple and then can be expanded up again to explain larger scale, more complex processes. In this case, we want to explain these ecological phenomena from inputs from the field of ornithology, vector biology, landscapes, virology, and phylogenetics. So I want to end with our surprising new finding, which my lab has been abuzz about recently, and get input, because help. If we step back to a broader spatial scale, you often see maps of West Nile virus on the internet that look like this. We have the US highlighted, then a little bit of West Nile in Canada, a little bit of Mexico, but they never show South America, or they usually don't even show Mexico or Central America. West Nile virus has not gone south like everyone suspected it would. Yes, we find it in southern Argentina, at latitudes in the southern hemisphere comparable to our northern latitudes here, but something is missing in central and northern South America. So there's, in a sense, a border fence along the US-Mexico border that seems to be preventing West Nile from being a big problem down there. So it's not just a physical barrier, it may also be some other type of barrier. And people have wondered about this virological Mexico border fence for a while and have hypothesized about it. There are really two prevailing hypotheses about this. The first is a herd immunity hypothesis. The idea is that maybe there are other flaviviruses down there already, and birds and mammals are already immune to West Nile-like viruses that have not yet been discovered, and maybe this just is an immunological barrier to the spread of the virus south. The other hypothesis has to do with vectors, and it's called superinfection exclusion, which comes right out of the field of experimental virology. Superinfection exclusion is the ability of one virus to exclude infection with a subsequent homologous viral challenge. So here we have, these are two cell culture systems. These are MDBK cells from a paper by Lee and colleagues at a Journal of Virology in 2005, showing that if you infect cells with this particular non-lytic form of BVDV first, nothing happens. But if you don't do that and you infect them with this homologous lytic form, you get CPE and plaque formation. But you can prevent that CPE and plaque formation by pre-infecting the cells with this non-lytic form of BVDV. And that is an example of superinfection exclusion, just to show you that it has to be a homologous virus. I didn't show the data here, but they repeated this experiment with vesicular stomatitis virus instead of the second form of BVDV. So it's this pre-infection with one virus is preventing infection with another. And this is demonstration of very similar data in the case of hepatitis C virus in another paper in HUH 7.5 cells. And the interesting thing about these two studies, there are many studies that have shown superinfection exclusion, but if you look at viral taxonomy, the hepatovirus genus, in which hepatitis C is a member, and the pestivirus genus, in which BVDV are a member, and the flavivirus genus, in which West Nile virus is a member, together form the family Flaviviridae. So people have speculated that this phenomenon of superinfection exclusion might be generalizable to all the flaviviruses, or all the Flaviviridae, and all the flaviviruses, and might account for the lack of spread of West Nile south of the border. And that became really exciting because of a new virus that was discovered just a few years ago that's garnered a lot of attention called Culex flavivirus. It's an insect-specific flavivirus in the genus flavivirus related to Committee River virus and cell-fusing agent virus. It's insect-specific because it grows in mosquito cell lines but won't replicate in mice, and it's probably vertically transmitted. You can find it in only male mosquitoes, or in pools of mosquitoes that are made of only males. And it's globally distributed. So it's a flavivirus that isn't transmitted between vertebrates and mosquitoes. It's a vertically transmitted virus within the mosquitoes themselves. And so people have thought, and Brad Blitvich and his colleagues at Iowa State found this thing at a fairly good infection rate in Yucatan, Mexico. They were looking for West Nile and other flaviviruses. They screened Culex quinquefasciatus mosquitoes and detected flavivirus RNA in 70% of the pools and 146 of the 210 pools. But of those 146 pools, 145 turned out to be Culex flavivirus, this insect-specific flavivirus. And one pool was a novel virus, tow virus. Who knows what that's doing? But no West Nile was detected. So is this evidence for superinfection exclusion? Or for superinfection exclusion in the ecology of West Nile virus? And just to make the wetter appetites a little bit more, here are some data that this group also published from Iowa showing fairly decent rates of Culex flavivirus infection in Culex pipiens mosquitoes from Iowa. So this is 10 mosquitoes per 1,000 tested. That's about what you see for West Nile virus. So this thing's in the United States as well. So could this superinfection exclusion idea be important? We were, fortunately, because of our studies, in a position to look at this. We had freezers full of banked RNA from mosquito pools and individual mosquitoes as a result of the blood meal study. So Christina Newman, a student in my lab, and I designed a novel nested reverse transcription PCR to detect this virus directly in mosquito pools, and we used a powerful epidemiological study design called the case control study, where we matched pools from 2006, which was a high year. We chose 134 West Nile positive Culex pools and 134 West Nile virus negative Culex pools, and we were also able to look at a handful of individual West Nile virus positive mosquitoes that we had banked over this time. And these pools were spatiotemporally matched. So we chose positive pools and negative pools from the same location collected at the same time, or as close in time as possible, to fulfill the criteria for a case control study. Our infection rates were sky high with Culex flavivirus. Yes, it's in Chicago in a big way. Remember, in Mexico and Yucatan, it was 10 per 1,000. Here, depending on which group of pools you look at, it's about 100 per 1,000. So West Nile virus infection rates in Chicago are about 10 or 11. These are 10 times higher. And Culex flavivirus infection rates in the Yucatan are about 20. This is 5 times higher than that. So we have a lot of this previously unknown virus flying and buzzing around Chicago. And the power of this case control study design became evident when we did McNamara's test for a paired case control data with continuity correction. This is an interesting test. If you have the same outcome, in this case, Culex flavivirus infection, between your cases and controls, you ignore that. It's not informative for your test. You only concentrate on discordant pairs where your outcome variable, Culex flavivirus infection status, differs between your case and your control. And when you make that comparison, we actually see a very statistically significant positive association between West Nile virus and Culex flavivirus in Chicago. The odds ratio was 4. So based on these data, a mosquito pool is 4 times more likely to be infected with Culex flavivirus if it's West Nile positive than if it's West Nile negative. We also looked at individual mosquitoes, and of our 15 West Nile positive mosquitoes, 40%, 6 of them, were also infected with Culex flavivirus. And this is why, those of you who hang out with me know I was really nervous when Lyric Bartholomew came a couple of weeks ago from Iowa, and I was going to tell her about these data. She studies, along with Brad Blitvich, super infection exclusion, and is very interested in this hypothesis as an explanation for the distribution of other flaviviruses. And they sent us the positive control samples for the study, and I had to tell them that our data basically torpedoed the idea of super infection exclusion in the field. So what are the explanations for our finding? Well, one explanation is something that you could call super infection enhancement. If this is happening at the level of a mosquito, perhaps one of these viruses, Culex flavivirus, the vertically transmitted one, might be co-evolved and selected for immunological crypsis. There's been some work done to show that these insect-only flaviviruses have a pattern of codon usage that's more similar to the mosquito than to other viruses within the genus flavivirus, suggesting an intimate co-adaptation. Maybe pre-infection with an insect-specific flavivirus prevents immunological recognition from related viruses. That's a testable hypothesis in the lab, and that's hopefully something that Christina will be pursuing. The other idea is that this could be an ecological phenomenon, and that the same environmental factors that lead to high rates of West Nile transmission in Chicago also lead to high rates of Culex flavivirus transmission, and that's also something that we'll be pursuing this summer by collecting individual mosquitoes. And just as a teaser, one of our findings is that we did in fact find a higher likelihood of Culex flavivirus infection in mosquito pools from these residential sites characterized by dense housing and impermeable surfaces than we did on our natural sites. And if you remember, this was the same pattern we found for West Nile virus genetic diversity. So no explanation. I can't tell you why this is happening, but this is the second time these darn residential sites have turned out to be higher in something unexpected than these natural sites. So finally, we built a phylogenetic tree of Culex flavivirus sequences from the Chicago area. And here I put red dots by the newly generated sequences, and they cluster with sequences from Japan, Iowa, and Texas, just a little divergent from Mexico and Ugandan sequences. But one thing that struck us was the similarity in the overall degree of genetic divergence of Culex flavivirus with, albeit a limited global sample, and the global diversity of West Nile virus that we see in this clade of the tree. And we can't help but wonder, although this is speculative, if there could be a positive association between these two viruses in the dynamics of their emergence. Could Culex flavivirus have facilitated the emergence of West Nile virus in some way? We don't know. So help those of you who have ideas about what might be happening inside the mosquitoes or inside of suburban Chicago. Please let us know. I'd very much like to hear from you, and so would Christina, who will be working on these issues for her PhD in my lab. And I'll just end it there, except to acknowledge that this is obviously a very large collaborative effort that could not happen without the cooperation of a great many universities, municipalities, and other well-wishers. So thanks very much, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Yeah.
I have a question actually on the increased biodiversity in the urban areas. Now, you mentioned that the little drains was kind of a unique thing to Chicago that was linked to there. Do you think that maybe difference in the could be associated with the mosquitoes breeding in the little cups of contained water, that is like a different behavior compared to the natural breeding in the lake, that maybe the different things are being selected for to enhance that behavior?
So the question is, could the storm drain somehow be causing differences in mosquito behavior or something about the way the mosquitoes are acting to alter transmission and evolutionary dynamics? I think that's it. Well, yes, they could. Now, the northern house mosquito, Culex pipiens, only breeds in little tree holes or small containers. It wouldn't breed in lakes. You know, a lot of people, when we walk around the neighborhoods, they say, oh, you're studying West Nile virus? That's great. It's going to be a bad year this year because I've gotten so many mosquito bites. No. Those mosquitoes are floodplain mosquitoes, Aedes vexans primarily, that don't transmit West Nile. Culex pipiens, the northern house mosquito, breeds in these small containers, bites at night. It's very subtle. So what could be happening, though, is these storm drains could be really increasing the density of these Culex pipiens mosquitoes artificially over what it would be in nature. And that high density of mosquitoes could have effects. And I do wonder if that's why we see so much West Nile transmission here, maybe such high infection rates with Culex flavivirus, which is a vertically transmitted virus. But yeah, they could definitely be making a difference. Yeah.
I'm kind of related to that. You kind of give a historical perspective of that 1904 being a hot spot. Were the, you know, the drains and the yards and stuff, was that also present in, you know, 100 years ago as well as 1975?
No, it wasn't. The drains in the yards phenomenon is 1940 to 1960 approximately. It just so happened as the city of Chicago expanded from the lake to the west, it hit a type of soil, which is why I showed that physiographic map, that made it necessary to put all these storm drains in there. And that happened in around 1960. So there was farmland in 1920 and just some development. So there, we don't know why it was such a typhoid-y, malarial area in the early 1900s. Yeah, Dave.
So, I got another thought. You can probably shoot this down with one piece of data, but what about the genetic diversity in the Culex and the mosquito? I mean, yeah. If they're vertically transmitted, then you're looking at the demographic phylogenetic structure in the mosquito. You've got two coexisting forms with differential propensities to be infected with flavivirus, if that would explain the correlation.
Yep, that's a distinct possibility. So could there be genetic variation in the mosquitoes? And in fact, I didn't present these data, but we've been collaborating with Ted Andriotis in Connecticut, who does a lot of mosquito genetics, and we actually find that there are at least two forms of Culex pipiens. There's variants here. There's Culex pipiens var pipiens, but there's also Culex pipiens var molestus. And the molestus variety of Culex pipiens actually, by our data and other people's data, has a higher feeding rate on mammals than the traditional Culex pipiens variety. So there are documented phenotypic differences between known genetic variants of Culex pipiens in this area that we're just beginning to understand. I mean, I just kind of peek at that and want to run away and shriek because it's so complicated. But yeah, there's stuff happening in the mosquitoes too, for sure. Yeah, John.
Another question on the potential higher diversity in residential areas. Could it be just that you have more diversity in the hosts? You've got human hosts, other animals that are around humans, whereas in the parks or whatever, you might just have your rodents and mosquitoes.
Yeah, so the question is, could the diversity and viral genetics difference between residential and natural sites be accounted for by a higher biodiversity of hosts in the residential areas? And we have data from our mist nets from the birds. We don't have data on mammals, but mammals aren't really that important. And it really is the other way around. These residential areas, it's robins and sparrows, robins and sparrows. I mean, we get to hate robins and sparrows in the yards by the end of the field season. Whereas all the gung-ho birders on our team love going to the cemeteries and the parks because they catch the flycatchers and the cardinals and all the other interesting species. So that the diversity goes the opposite
because
way.
Because robins and sparrows are so important, that might...
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
is that?
I was wondering if humans at all could have some role in the evolution of the virus.
Certainly humans don't have a role in selecting for variants of the virus within their bodies that then get passed on because humans are a dead end host. But I mean, humans have a fundamental role in the ecology in altering the landscape. So that's how they're doing it.
Just a question on methodology. You plotted up something like cumulative temperatures over different years,
yeah.
Deviations, and I wonder why you don't take something like integrate over different windows and look at, given a hot period of several weeks, and look at how those periods might correlate with some of the events.
We have done a little bit of that. We've kind of I showed you the coarsest scale analysis. So we separated out years and characterized them by hot years versus cool years. But we also tried other metrics. So you know the early hotness of a year or the early hot precipitationness of a year. You know all these different things to try to capture what people thought were the important climatological variables. So the bottom line is that everybody knows what causes intense West Nile transmission. It's a lot of it's wet period early in the season followed by hot and dry. But then all the water dries up everywhere else except in these storm drains and the mosquitoes breed there. If you get late rains, it washes out the mosquito larvae. So
that's more dominant than the robin hatchling?
Well, they're coincident in time. So the robin hatchling influx happens at the same time as we see the hottest, driest parts of the summer. So it's all overlapping, and that's how we've sort of built this conceptual model that everything's coming together in addition to our blood meal data and our seroprevalence data and all that. But you're right, it's piecing together pieces of a puzzle that fall a little short of actually proving causality. Yeah.
It looked to me as if your temperature hotspots nearly coincided with your few infection hotspots.
So we actually haven't done the fine-scale temperature analysis to say that. If I showed a picture of urban heat islands in Chicago, that was just something off the internet to demonstrate the phenomenon. We're actually in the process of collecting these fine-scale COCO-ROS weather station data and making surfaces of temperature and rainfall across the study area, but we haven't actually shown that. That's a that's our prediction, though, that we're going to see coincidence.
I guess one basic question is I'm just wondering whether, have you looked at the incidence of the, how many people own air conditioners?
Everybody. But we actually did have a student who tried to look at human behavior and say, is it the hottest, driest parts of the summer where the people also tend to go outside and sit on their porches more? And yes, but it's hard to quantify. So that could also be a factor. People could be more at risk through their behavior at exactly the right time as well. So there are certainly human dimensions of this that we haven't quantified. Yeah, Brett.
It seems, for the difference in genetic diversity, you know, this is the big one. It seems like and people are kind of saying this a little bit, but the simplest idea is just that you have different population sizes, right? In the residential area versus the...
Yes.
And then, of course, the question is why?
Well, that's right. So but it's very difficult, considering these are sometimes less than a kilometer apart, to imagine that a mosquito couldn't, that there's not mosquito gene flow, a lot of it, between these areas. And that's why we're doing the stable isotope marker capture study, so we can actually quantify how far mosquitoes move. Maybe these are really small, more isolated populations of Culex than we ever thought.
Right.
But and that is an explanation, and maybe the dynamics of transmission within those populations differ, but we don't know.
But as you were saying, I mean, if you just have a higher density of the host, you know, the higher density of mosquitoes in the residential areas, then it would be easy to accommodate possibly a higher population size of the virus.
Yep, that's an explanation.
Sure, I was paying
attention. Any other
good
questions?
No help with Culex flavivirus, huh? Okay.
Everybody's staying away from that.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. Well, thanks very much.